In this second lecture, I want to continue on economic anthropology. The first lecture, if you remember, was about four approaches to anthropology: formalism, or neoclassical maximizing theory, and the stages of growth, political economy, relations of politics and economics, which is what I'm going to be talking about today. Substantivism, embedded society in the 20th century, and culture and technology, which will be the last lecture. And I looked at the four major ways of producing wealth and their correlates, or some of them, in hunters and gatherer societies and tribesmen and peasants and industrial societies. This one I want to now move into the 19th century, the things that really concerned 19th century sociologists, most obviously Marx, but also Weber and others, which is to do with the relations of production, wealth distribution, and property and stratification. If I asked you what property was, I wonder how many of you would really know what property is. If I said, what is your property? Say, in relation to this mobile phone that's been handed in, you might well say, well, that's my property. The mobile phone is my property. What I'm going to show to you is that that's a very, what Marx would call, fetishistic view of property. It's much both simpler and more complicated than that, as I'll explain. The second thing is, if I asked you whether human beings were naturally equal or unequal, you would obviously immediately say, well, what do you mean by naturally? But putting that one on one side, would you agree with Rousseau that more of men are born free and it's society that enchains them? Or are they born in different degrees of freedom, in some very unfree? So what is the natural state of man? And that is another question which I'll be going into in this lecture. So let's start with property. What is property? There's a plan there, and I hope I've covered all the people whose names I'll mention as I go through my lecture. Well, there's a useful book called Notes and Queries in Anthropology, and it defines property or ownership in the following way. Ownership is best defined as the sum total of rights which various persons or groups of persons have over things. The things thus owned are property. Property thus defined, and this is the important part, in terms of the relations of persons to things. Now, that's really the essence and the most important thing to grasp about property. When I was around your age, I always thought, used to think it was the thing itself that was property. The property is a three-way, or a relationship between me, this phone, and you. And the owner of this phone. At the moment, since possession is 9/10 of the law, I could probably walk away with this phone and keep it for myself, and whoever is wondering where their phone has gone would lose it to me. But I have a relation with that person, I have a relation with you, I could try and flog it off in an auction or something, and it is the relationship between you and a thing. And that kind of relationship is often conceived of as a bundle of relationships, because it isn't just a single relationship. Why we get into this fetishistic way of looking at property, as Marx pointed out, is because we live in a capitalist society where many of the relations are all bundled together into one. We have almost absolute private property, or so it seems. In most societies, this bundle is separated off. And I often illustrate this in relation to this moderately nice hat of mine. My wife is always trying to straighten out for me, and has failed this morning. Anyway, this hat here is my property. That's to say, at the moment it's in my hands, but you could see how it could be divided up. I could, for instance, let out this hat. Anyone who offers me £10 a week, I could, and you could have the use of the hat. I could sublet it, so you could then let it out to someone below else. I could destroy it, I could sell it. I have all sorts of different rights in it, and That's one of the features of property in most societies, that the rights are held by a whole lot of different people, and there are different kinds of rights. For instance, there are rights of use, rights to control the use or disposal of property to others, rights to derive an income or other benefit from the use of property by others, rights to be described as a titular owner of property, and you could either have them separate or together. And of course, property itself, you probably think rather, again, rather materialistically, as I do, as property being a thing. Property can be almost anything, and it doesn't have to be a physical thing. For example, in the Encyclopedia of Social Sciences, it says of the types of property, property is a euphonious, that's a nice sounding collection of letters, P-R-O-P-E-R-T-Y, which serves as a general term for the miscellany, that's a whole set of equities, that is rights, that persons hold within a commonwealth. A coin, what we think of that as a property, a lance, a tapestry, a monastic vow, a yoke of oxen, a female slave, an award of alimony, a home, a first mortgage, a railroad system, a preferred list and a right of contract are all to be discovered within this Catholic category. So it can be what are known as material things or immaterial things. It could be a right, for instance, to say a grace at the end of a meal in a Cambridge college. That could be considered to be one of your properties. The right I have, which is my most cherished right because it plays well with my grandchildren, the right to walk across the grass in King's College lawn, which is the only thing they really esteem me for. That is not a material right, but it's an immaterial right. So the questions you can ask is, what is the nature of property? Who holds the property? What is the basic property-owning unit? And how is property transmitted? In relation to stratification, we come back to this question of whether human beings are born equal or unequal. There are two views, really, of humans, and I'll go through them in more detail later. One is that by birth, human beings are unequal. The moment you are born, whether it's a woman and a man, or whether it's a slave or a freeman, you are born unequal. It's written in the stars or a former life. The other is that we are born equal, even if we end up with unequal wealth or whatever. Now, it's rather difficult for us because in the last 200 years, the second view that human beings are born equal has come to dominate the ideologies of the world. And it's difficult for some of us, not all of us perhaps, to go back into a world where the opposite assumption was made. But I'll explain that actually was the main assumption until around about the middle of the 18th century and the French Revolution and the American Revolution. We now live in a time and a part of the world where there's a basic premise that human beings are born equal. As Ernest Gellner, his name is there, writes, a marked feature of modern societies is the basic egalitarianism. And it's a form of religion, it's a form of ideology. You can't prove it one way or the other, but most people believe it. For example, Ruth Benedict, the American anthropologist, wrote a contrast in America and Japan. She wrote that equality is the highest, most moral American basis for hopes for a better world. All the rhetoric about democracy and equality that justifies invading countries and so on is a basic ideological premise that we are all equal and everyone should be in that position. As Crystal, again on the reading list, writes it under equality in the International Encyclopedia of Social Sciences. Incidentally, those are I think you'll find the second edition is in the SPS library. Both editions are in the Haddon, and they're very good. If you're doing an essay on something, it's often very worthwhile to go to the International Encyclopedia of Social Sciences and just look up marriage, kinship, exchange, gifts, whatever. It's always a very good start. Anyway, Crispell writes, it is a distinguishing characteristic of the modern age that equality should be not merely an abstract idea, but also a politically aggressive idea. Every inequality is on the defensive, must prove itself against the imputation of injustice and unnaturalness. Or as the French anthropologist, sociologist who wrote one of the most famous books on inequality, Homo Hierarchicus, Louis Dumont writes, "For us, every man is in principle an embodiment of humanity at large, and as such he is equal to every other man and free." And finally, just to give you one final thought from perhaps the greatest writer on inequality in the English language in the 20th century, George Orwell, who wrote that in This is the Lion and the Unicorn, "The whole English-speaking world is haunted by the idea of human equality. And though it would be simply a lie to say that either we or the Americans have ever acted up to our professions, still, the idea is there, and it is capable of one day becoming a reality." So, that's just a start. What is property? Are we equal or unequal? And I now want to look through the modes of production I talked about last time to see how they've regarded these things and what is property and stratification in these societies. So starting with hunters and gatherers, in these societies, traditionally, there is probably a great deal of natural equality, almost perfect. To a large extent, people are born equal and remain more or less equal. There are no great wealth differences. Certainly in the immediate return hunter-gatherers that I talked about, then there's very, very little personal property. But it's very important to not sentimentalize this or romanticize it or take it too far, as Marx did. One of the reasons why his vision was so destructive and unproductive in the end is that he didn't understand that there is both communal and private property in hunter-gatherer societies. For example, Robert Lowy, who was a great American anthropologist, wrote about the Torres Straits, which is off North Australia, that there was very highly individualized private property there. He writes, "Every rock and waterhole had its owner, the only common piece of common land being the village street, and it's been discovered in many hunter-gatherer societies that there is private property. The Andaman Islanders, A-N-D-A-N-A-N, islanders in the Indian Ocean, they don't have much private property of material wealth, but magic, songs and legends are private property. For example, Robert Lowy writes, "A song that has been received with applause may be repeated by request at lesser gatherings, but irrespective of its popularity, no one dares sing it except the composer himself." So the idea that intellectual property rights and cultural property rights are a new phenomenon, you find them in these very simplest. So those who are considering the problems of downloading music to your iPod and so on, this is a problem that the Andaman Islanders faced. You could repeat it if there'd been applause, but the intellectual property remained with the composer of the original song. Or, among another group, "When a woman sells an incantation, she must promise that she gives it up entirely and that the buyer will become the only possessor of its mysterious power." But basically, there's not much inequality or property because of the obvious fact that it's very difficult to store it. You go out, you hunt, you gather, but you can't store it in any way. You can't bank it for the future. And if you take the analogy of the hat, if this was a hat in a Hadza or Kum village, it would be just shared round. I mean, I couldn't say this is my hat and keep it from other people if they needed it. If it was a very hot day, someone wanted my hat, they would borrow it, perhaps without asking me, because it really isn't my property. The foreshadowing of ranks and private property, though, is to be found in these hunter-gatherer societies, in the delayed return ones that I mentioned in Woodburn's famous distinction. Here, you can create some surpluses. You can create surpluses of meat, fish, oil, nuts, berries, and so on, and store them. And so you begin to get differentials of wealth. You begin to get small chiefs some form of ranking, political ranking, competition for these resources, and you famously get displays of wealth and the famous potlatch, that's P-O-T-L-A-T-C-H, where people conspicuously destroy wealth to shame their rivals, which I'll talk about in the next lecture on exchange. But there's little long-term institutionalization of rank. You get sort of beginnings of big men, but not much inequality of rank. It's possible to talk of temporary differences, achieved differences in people, but not really permanent ranks or classes in these societies. We now move on to tribal societies and dividing them into the two kinds, into the ones who keep animals, pastoralists. Of course, there are very many different kinds, and they're rather different depending whether you keep cows, reindeer, camels, sheep, and so on. But on the whole, the central feature of these kind of societies is that this mode of production again inhibits the development of ranks, of classes, of castes, of serious long-term ranks. Property in these societies is held not by an individual, or even by a small family group. It's held by, usually by lineage or a group of relatives. So again, this hat would not be held by me or even my domestic household, but by my sub-lineage, by 5, 10, 15 males and females who would share rights in this hat. So beyond some ornaments and household furnishings, people don't really have private property in this situation. Secondly, the second feature of these sort of societies is that the major form of property, of course, is a mixture of animals, but also people. We tend to think of property again as things, but actually the most important property in most societies is rights in people rather than in things. And you've probably come across this, that women, their labour, their reproductive rights in particular, are famously property, regarded as things which the group have rights in, and that's how you get the exchange of them between groups in marriage systems and so on. It's rights in people that are the main concern. You can always get more cattle, but getting people is the most difficult thing. For ultimately, whether a group survives or is wiped out depends on social relations. It's not what you have, it's who you know, so to speak, that are important. Finally, the distribution of property is fairly even. There's a sort of homeostatic regulating device in many pastoral societies. A group gets to a certain size, its herds get to a certain size, and then it becomes economically and socially not any advantage to have a larger size. So you can't get the phenomenon that you get in capitalist societies where after the first million, you accumulate more and more and more millions, and there are ways of controlling that. Most pastoral societies have groups of quite small groups of men and women who are looking after a quite small herd. The famous examples of Evans, Pritchard and Manure, and the Patans by Frederick Barth, whose name is there, work on reindeers and so on, all show that they are fiercely egalitarian. The feuding, which I'll talk about later, is a manifestation. If a tribe or subgroup gets too big for its boots, so to speak, its herds get too big, then other groups join up against it and predate and bring it back to size, so that the groups are rising and then brought back, and there's a levelling out. The main form of stratification in these societies is by sex and by age. And this is, again, I think, can quite easily all of this be explained in terms of the mode of production. Laws of diminishing marginal returns, which means the law, the very important law in economics, whereby at a certain point, as you put more effort into things, then you get less returns. I mean, it's one of the two or three economic laws which I hope all of you understand, and if you don't, the example is if you work very hard at an essay for 3 days, you'll get a good mark. If you work for 10 days, you'll only get a a sort of better mark, but not worth the extra 7 years' work. Many, many tasks that we do are like that. You get diminishing returns, and it's the same with keeping herds. There, you have to move faster, the herds graze, there are all these predators around. There are various ways in which it's not sensible to go above a certain level. Turning to the other form of tribal society, horticulturalists, here we have, again, incipient ranking of storage. There are real surpluses, as I mentioned last time, that if you live in a forest traditionally, and you practice Sweden or cultivation, slash and burn cultivation, you can produce quite large surpluses with not too much effort. And again, wealth is produced by the effort of women. Pigs in New Guinea, for instance, are largely kept by women, and therefore the trick in these societies is to control human beings, who will then produce the wealth. But again, wealth is held not by individuals, but by a group of kin, usually descent through males, agnetic descent, or sometimes through females, uterine, uterus, womb descent, who share resources and labour. Again, it's who you know rather than the actual things you have, which are important. It's quite possible to accumulate quite large amounts of private wealth. I will be showing a film in a couple of weeks on New Guinea society, Onka's Big Mopper, which is about how a big man in New Guinea tries to manipulate the system so that he can create more wealth, and he's pretty successful. So you begin to get in these societies chiefs and commoners, slaves and free, and the conspicuous display of wealth differences, but you can't really talk about it as a caste or class society. And the big men complexes of New Guinea and other societies are characteristic. They are very, very fragmentary and temporary. They are set up through reciprocities of exchange and indebtedness. There is no way, again, of banking things except in other people. So you give a feast and then they owe you things and so on. But that's a rather inefficient way, certainly of long-term creating differences. Roughly speaking, each generation starts anew. I always think when I'm talking about this or conceptualizing, it reminds me very much of playing marbles at my boarding school when I was a little boy. How many of you have ever played marbles? I don't know whether it's... Oh, that's good. Quite a lot still. Okay, well, I don't know whether you had this pop-latching phenomenon in your school, but what we used to do was you'd start the year with no marbles and you'd go grub around in the undergrowth and try and find a marble, or your parents might give you 3 or 4 marbles to start with. So you start with nothing, everyone is equal. And then you play through the season, and by the end of it there are a few people who have these huge sacks of marbles, and there are the rest of us who have just 1 or 2 marbles because we're not so good at throwing them. What do you do with these marbles? They give you prestige during that particular term, which is usually the winter term. At the end of the term, you go, in my school, you went up some steps, stood up, and then you told everyone you were going to do this, and they all came, and then you just threw all your marbles in all directions, and they all rushed around and tried to pick up 1 or 2, which they would then use at the beginning of the following year, and you yourself would divest yourself and start again. This is roughly what a big man society is. You accumulate, you have feasts, you give it away, and then your children have to start all over again. You can't pass it on, there's no educational system. So there is some hierarchy and differences, but each generation starts anew. Now, those systems I've talked about so far, I've talked about at some length because you won't be told about them in any other lectures, probably, and secondly, because they do constitute about 90% of human history and human beings who lived on this planet, hunters and gatherers and tribal people. But most of you are more concerned with the next two, which are peasants and industrial people. So I'd now like to turn to agrarian civilizations. About 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, or a little more, you get the development of agrarian civilizations, where you get mechanisms to store and transmit wealth, money, the great store of wealth. the possibility of storing and transferring information, writing, the possibility of storing and transferring power, weapons of power, killing people and so on, the possibility of storing and transferring people, cities, and the possibility of extracting much greater wealth from the earth through ploughs, animal traction, wheels, and so on. This led into the forms of civilization which dominated the earth until about 200 years ago. And here you can have really large surpluses of wealth which will then sustain a stratified system. There is enough so that 1% perhaps of the population cannot do any of this production at all, but just run the others. And you begin to get what is almost universal in human societies, a threefold distinction between three kinds of tasks. What Ernest Gellner, in a book he called Plough, which is production, agricultural production, sword, this is the title of his book, Plough, Sword and Book, sword, destruction and rule, and book, cognition and religion. And nearly all of the great civilizations between 3000 BC and 1850, 1800 and on Earth were divided into those three functions. They were various different kinds. There were classical slave peasantries. Here property is mainly held by the state and by the free. Furthermore, property is still heavily to do with rights in people as things, that is, in as people as inanimate objects. The ancient, or as Marx called it, or slave mode of production is the one that dominated in nearly all civilizations up to about the time of Rome, and that is Egypt, Assyria, the Aztecs, the Incas, Greece, and to a certain extent China. And this is a system which divides the population into two main strata, the free, who encompass the rulers and the literati, and the unfree, who are the slaves. We're often taught about the wonders of democracy and how it all came from Greece and so on. But remember that when Aristotle and Plato were talking about democracy in Greece, they were talking about the top 10% who were free. The rest of them had no access to democracy whatsoever. They had no vote, they weren't citizens, they were nothing, they were chattels. And likewise, when the Americans went on about democracy in their country before 1860 or whatever, they were talking about a society where some were free and some were not part of the process at all, were slaves. So democracy as a universal concept is very recent, and it doesn't stem directly in some ways from Greece and Rome. In such societies, man is by nature unequal. You're born either free or unfree. And slaves are people who are just a factor of production. They are just chattels. They are things you can buy, sell, destroy, kill, maim, do what you like with. They are just like this mobile phone. They're no more, no less. And that was the state of most civilizations on Earth for several thousand years. The great alternative system is the caste system. This comes from a Portuguese word meaning sexual purity or sexual relations. It's a system which is based on the idea of in marriage, in endogamy, you marry within the caste, you eat within the caste, you have social relations with people within the caste, including touching them in many situations. And everything is ranked according to these groupings. Now, here there are those three main groups that I mentioned before. There are the rulers, Kshatriya in India, the rulers, the priests, the Brahmins, and the workers, the Vaishya. These in the Indian caste system are clean castes. They are white. You could, in certain circumstances, a Brahmin take uncooked food from someone elsewhere and so on. They are not utterly polluting and they're not outside the system. And those are the three functions. And then there are the black untouchable sudra who are deeply polluting to all the other castes. And of course much of Indian history in the last 100 years has been trying to deal with this problem. The odd feature about caste systems, one of the odd features, is that it's based not on wealth, as most systems are, but on ritual purity. You are more or less pure in relation to God. So it has a very strong religious and ideological component. The other thing, which I think is very might be very important for you to grasp hold of, is when we talk about hierarchy, the word has two meanings. Most people, when they use the word hierarchy, they just mean a stratified system with a top, a middle, and a lower. When people talk about hierarchy in the caste system, they're talking about something entirely different. I'll just show you with a diagram. Can you hear me when I talk like this? Okay, well, stratified systems, like caste systems, like ours, like drawers in a cabinet, and you are in one of these drawers. Hierarchy, as used technically by Dumont and Indians, means an organic system in which different parts have a meaning in relation to other parts. The Brahmins are the head, the Kshatriya are the body, the Vaishya are the arms and the legs and so on, the Sudra are something else. No part has any meaning except in relation. It's a relational or structural approach to stratification. So it's all to do with the relations between groups and their functional interconnectedness. And it's based on an organic metaphor of a body rather than a mechanical metaphor of a series of strata, like a geological strata. And of course it's based on premise of deep inequality. You are born into one of these castes and you shouldn't aspire to move out of it, though there are ways of doing so. If we turn now to the other main systems in the period before the Industrial Revolution, you have a system which is mainly to be found in Western Europe and Japan, which are systems of estates or orders. And they're not classes and they're not castes, but they are different kinds or levels of equality and inequality. And there are really three main kinds of these. There are patrimonial systems, which encompass Islam and China. There are classic feudal systems, which encompass much of continental Western Europe. And there is centralized feudalism, which encompasses England and Japan. Now, the patrimonial system is one where you have a very powerful central leader, certainly in the Chinese case, and the whole of the nation is organized like a household, as an extension of the royal household. It's sometimes attacked as a form of oriental despotism or absolutism, and it's certainly very different from the feudal systems of the West. When Mao called the previous system as he was attacking the feudal, he was just lumping it as something he didn't like. And in fact, the feudalism of China is very different from the feudalism of the West. The feudalism of the West has two main branches. Classic feudalism is basically, in the one wonderful phrase of Mark Bloch, B-L-O-C-H, who wrote the great book on feudal society, the dissolution of the state. Everything is to do with contractual oaths of fealty between an individual and their lord. It's a contractual, flexible system which emerged after the collapse of the Roman Empire in the, and existed all over Europe between the 6th and the 13th century. It later turned into what de Tocqueville called caste, that is birth-given differences, but for 6 centuries it was really much more fluid and much more based on individual decisions to form allegiances and alliances with people. But it was very decentralized. Each lord and feudal noble had his followers and there was endless war between them and so on. The other kind is what you call, has been called centralized feudalism, which you find in England and Japan. And here you get a very powerful central state, but also it's the whole thing is arranged on the feudal principle of sub-imputation, as it's called, power being delegated down and down. If you want a model of that, then Cambridge University is a very still an existing example of this. There is a central organisation, and then that's delegated down through levels and levels and levels through councils of schools and faculty boards and departments and teachers and down to you and I. The last is class societies. You know more about this. These are based on powerful new technologies of industrialism where machines take the place of human labour. We move from an organic metaphor of interconnectedness like the caste systems and to a certain extent the ranking systems to one of there are geological levels and faults or boxes. And there's been a move towards the premise of natural equality. That was the premise of the American and French Revolution. They asserted that men are born free and equal, which most people in history wouldn't have agreed with, but that was thought to be a self-evident truth, and certainly by proclaiming it, they aimed for it. And you end up with a situation which is very odd, because everyone is born free and equal, anyone can become anything, and yet we all end up unequal. As Tawney and Orwell, among others, stingingly remind us, though all animals and humans are equal, some are definitely more equal than others. Perhaps the pyramid is a little flatter than in rank and caste societies, but it's certainly not absolutely flat. So there's a strange contradiction in our system, and as I explained to Lily, it can have a big psychological effect, it certainly does in Japan and England, which is that we are all told that we're equal. The ideology says everyone has the same chance. We don't all have the same chance, and we certainly don't end up equal at the end. So many people have a double burden. They have failed to become rich and successful, and they also that is their own fault. At least in the ascribed status systems, like caste systems, it's based on your birth and your stars and your previous life and so on. So most people find they are unequal, and many societies are becoming more unequal. Communism is the other main system, obviously, and here, in theory, it destroys all classes and all inequalities, but in practice, as was soon discovered and Orwell pointed out, in practice, very soon, it all creeps back in again in an informal, indirect and nasty and vicious way. So that members of the party do well and others don't do so well and so on and so on. So the two great cases of experimenting with this, Soviet Union and China, have been disastrous failures in that respect. The state has not withered and inequalities have not withered. So we have a situation where the abolition of class is desired but hasn't occurred. The abolition of caste and rank has to a certain extent occurred. And we are in a world where in many societies like America, Japan and elsewhere the inequalities are growing rather than decreasing. So it's up to you folks to do something about it. Thank you very much.